small talk. I originally was thinking I was just going to give a group meeting, but decided that I couldn't say anything in half an hour. So I'm going to talk about, what I want to emphasize in the talk today is the so-called Carroll symmetry. And I don't imagine that many of you know too much about what that is. So I want to sort of introduce it and emphasize that it's something that is a useful organizing principle whenever we're thinking about some sort of physics on null hypersurfaces. And in fact, what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you. So the concept of Carroll symmetry has existed in the literature for a few years. The motivation for me was to sort of understand the notion of Carroll symmetry at a geometric level and in a generic geometric setting. Okay, so often, often we have in mind, if we're thinking about null hypersurfaces, we might be thinking about scry plus in an asymptotically flat geometry. Okay, that's one example, but we also might be thinking about black hole horizon. We might be thinking about some entanglement questions, something like that. And so I think it's important to understand what the generic geometry really is. Okay, so that's the motivation. And another motivation that is sort of in the future, I think, for me is to think about what might be meant by flat holography. Okay, so we all believe that gravity is holographic in general, but our standard example of holography, of course, is in asymptotically ADS geometries. And if you were at the talk if you were at the group meeting last week, Luca gave a short introduction to his work on the fluid gravity correspondence. And one of the interesting things that they realized was that there's a smooth limit where you take the ADS radius, or you take the cosmological constant to zero. And if you do things right, what you find is that the relativistic fluid sitting at the ADS boundary becomes a fluid that you can think about as propagating on scry plus in an asymptotically flat geometry. As I said, you have to do it right. You have to organize things properly. But they did it in the sense of essentially a generic relativistic fluid. And there are lots of properties of that fluid, like vorticity and shear and expansion and acceleration and all of that, which persist in this limit. Okay, so all of those features of the fluid you would expect to be probable on the corresponding null hypersurface. Okay, so again, that's an example of a null hypersurface which happens to be at infinity in some geometry. And they essentially were able to scan through all algebraically special geometries in that work. Okay, of course, another aspect of, one of the motivations for talking about flat holography is in the work of Strominger et al. On soft theorems in field theories. Somewhat vaguely, there's a proposed duality between what are S matrix elements in the bulk and correlation functions of some theory on a component of the boundary. Okay, so often that's discussed. So what informs you about that system, about that proposed duality, are the soft theorems themselves, which operate at or near zero frequency. So they're essentially describing time independent phenomena. So you get some you get some glimpse into a duality there, but you're sort of sensitive to time independent or weekly time dependent phenomena. And I think that's really the reason that the duality that they talk about is actually a duality between, as I said, the S matrix elements in the bulk and a CFT on a codimension 2. In the case of Scribe Plus, it's a codimension 2 sphere. Okay. I suspect, though, that this is just part of a bigger story, okay, where there's a duality to what I will refer to as, well, I'm not going to refer to it at all in this talk, but for now, what I'll refer to it as is in quotes, a CFT on a chiral structure. And this replaces the notion of, our usual notion of CFT on Riemannian manifolds. Okay, so that's sort of motivation for the future. Okay, there's more to the duality than just time-independent phenomena. Okay. Lastly, another motivation and another reason to think that there's something more general going on here is the general theory of soft modes that many people here, for example, have been working on for years. And so from that point of view, we know that there are degrees of freedom that have support on edges and corners and things like that. It's a fact that the existing literature on chiral symmetry and the corresponding VMS symmetries make essentially no reference to any such degrees of freedom. Okay? And that's a gap that I'm trying to fill in here. Okay? And to jump to the conclusion, what we're going to find is that BMS symmetry in fact persists in a pretty general situation, pretty general scenario, where there are clear restrictions on features of the geometry that'll introduce in order that the symmetry still be there. Okay, and lastly, I think you know, null geometries we should really think of as non-Riemannian spacetimes. And they're interesting just from that point of view, and we should understand how to treat them from that point of view. Okay. So why the word chiral? So the original, I think the origin of the term refers to an ultra-relativistic limit, which is not the subject of this talk at all. But just to get our feet wet, let's remind ourselves how that works. Okay, if we just take Minkowski space or something similar to Minkowski space with a metric like this, and I'm going to put in explicit factors of the speed of light now. Okay, the ultra-relativistic limit that I'm referring to corresponds to sending c goes to zero. Okay, and it's clear that the metric degenerates apparently in this limit. Okay, and what's going on? One way to describe what's going on, and this is the way that people often talk about this sort of system, is that the metric is developing a kernel. Okay, and in these coordinates, the kernel is, you can think of as just d by dt, something proportional to d by dt. Okay, this becomes zero in the c goes to zero limit. Okay, or more generally, what people often do is they describe a chiral structure or a so-called chiral manifold by specifying a space and a metric and a vector field, which is in the kernel of G. Okay, but I think to refer to this as a Carroll manifold is a little bit strange because, you know, it sounds like you're defining a manifold by the properties of some geometric structure on it. And what I'm going to build for you is a structure where the appropriate diffeomorphisms are realized appropriately. Okay, so in particular, there are what are called Carroll diffeomorphisms, which are a subset of the general diffeomorphisms of the spacetime, which preserve this structure that I referred to here. Okay, and in these coordinates, they look like the following set of transformations. Okay, so if I only allow myself to change the x coordinates by a time independent factor, but allow the time to change arbitrarily like this, okay, this is a special, as I said, it's a subset of the diffeomorphisms. Just to introduce notation, I'm going to define Rij as the usual spatial Jacobian matrix, because x prime is a function of x only. The components are a function of the x's. And similarly, I'll call ji dt prime by dxi. I'll refer to j as dt prime by dt. And because of this, dx prime by dx prime by dt is zero. Okay, so the Jacobian is that I'm referring to here is upper triangular. Okay, and as I was saying, these transformations preserve this structure in the sense that hij is a tensor. Okay, it's invariant under these. In other words, the components transform in their familiar way. And the kernel is invariant up to scale. Okay, so in other words, D. The basis vector d by dt transforms to this j times dt prime. I'll denote vector fields by underlines, by the way. You need to be careful about, because of the singular structure here, you need to be careful about what's a form and what's a vector, and so I'll denote those that way. Okay, so I just wanted to write that down because it will be important structure as we go along. Okay, and what I want to advocate is that it's this symmetry which sort of controls the structure on generic null hypersurfaces. And as I was saying, I'm not really interested in talking about ultra-relativistic limits, but rather talking about for example, null hypersurfaces. And so let me just quickly demonstrate, though, that this sort of structure exists on all of the familiar null hypersurfaces that you might think of. Okay, so indeed, if I consider Scri plus in, say, Minkowski in D plus two dimensions, okay, so one way to write the metric, of course, is in the standard way. I'll go to radial coordinates. And in this case, the hypersurface is at large R, at large constant R. Okay. And of course, this is conformal. This is conformal to that metric. Okay. And you can see that, well, if dr is constant, or if I go to the hypersurface at constant r, then this is behaving much like the c squared dt squared did as r goes off to infinity. Okay, and if you like, you can go to better coordinates where things are less singular. Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, for example. Actually, let me write that down. Okay, and in these coordinates, the middle term just smoothly goes to zero, and the point is that this is subleading to a codimension two piece of the metric. Okay, so we can talk about that system, that null hypersurface, in the same way. Another example is, say, the Schwarzschild horizon. Okay, standard Schwarzschild coordinates. And again, if you go to tortoise coordinates, I won't go through the details. The metric looks very similar to this. In this case, the hypersurface isn't at large R, it's at the horizon radius. Okay, but the hypersurface is at constant r, so this goes away smoothly, and you can see that as you go to the horizon, this is becoming null, as is presumably familiar. Okay, and so what's happening here is that, well, the coordinates that I've defined here, d by dr is null. Okay, there's no dr squared term in the metric. And what's happening is that d by du becomes null as you go to the null hypersurface. Okay, so that's the, if you like, in that language, that d by du is the kernel of the induced metric. Okay, so even more generally, what one can do is argue that this applies to any null hypersurface. Okay, and the argument goes as follows. In any spacetime, I could choose a coframe. Which I'm going to call E minus, E plus, and EI, where I goes to 1 to D. Okay, I haven't specified coordinates at all. I'm just, you could choose some coordinates, but these are the names given to the coframe. And I'm going to choose these to be dual to null vectors. And I can always write the metric, if they're null, in the following way. Okay, where A to AB is the, so A and B here run from plus and minus. Okay, A to AB is the usual constant Minkowski local metric. And as I said, this implies that the corresponding dual vectors are null. Or by dual, as usual, I mean they're dual to these forms that I've produced. Okay, and so in this context, what you can do is instead of thinking about a hypersurface or necessarily foliating the spacetime by a series of hypersurfaces, instead what you can define is a null distribution. So let's, I'll refer to this as C of E minus. And this is just the span of all vectors which are annihilated by the form E minus. Okay, that doesn't define a foliation necessarily, but it's as close as you need. There could be, given some integrability conditions, this, assuming the integrability conditions are satisfied, this would define a foliation. Okay, it's a foliation where the null vector E minus is the normal vector.
Sort of. Yeah. You have to think of E minus as just a tangent vector in the time direction.
So, this E minus. So this is a form, right? So I mean the pairing between the form E minus and an arbitrary vector. So it's also. In other words, contract the indices. Right? So in a specific case, that's right. In this case, you could take the form E minus to be du, and the corresponding vector field is whatever it is. Okay. And okay, in this setup, right? This is simply. This is just a subbundle of the tangent bundle that is spanned by E plus and the vectors EI. Okay, so arbitrary linear combinations of those. Okay, but from this point of view, the metric, the induced metric on this space becomes singular. It just becomes this Hij. Okay, so the point is that construction constructs for you, given the integrability conditions, a null hypersurface or perhaps a null foliation, and the same sort of Carroll structure is present there. Okay, well, so what's the issue then? So if we go back to these Carroll diffeomorphisms that preserved the metric and the spatial metric and its kernel, you can ask, well, what are the significance of those? Or more precisely, what's the natural geometric structure for which those restricted diffeomorphisms are natural? Okay. Well, if I just took an arbitrary manifold, I would say those transformations are unnatural because they're not the most general set of diffeomorphisms. Okay, so instead, one can think of these transformations as natural on a fiber bundle Okay, in the following sense, okay, let me refer to the fiber bundle as sigma. Okay, S is the spatial, is you can think of it as a spatial submanifold. And to draw a picture here, what I have in mind is that there's this space S here, okay, with a one-dimensional fiber above each point. And what I can do is, well, the spatial changes of coordinates referred to up there, you can just think about that, you know, as introducing a chart of open sets on the base, and those transformations just correspond to changing coordinates on the base. And I'm going to think about the fibers as parameter, you know, points on the fibers is parameterized by a coordinate t. Okay, and the changes of coordinates t prime as a function of t and x just means that I can change coordinates on the fiber, on any given fiber at any given point x in the base, and I can do that independently on each fiber. Okay, so what's the point? The point is that I just gave you a geometric structure for which these coordinate transformations are natural. Okay. Of course, if you think about the space sigma as itself a manifold, there are generic diffeomorphisms that screw up this structure. Okay, but the Carroll diffeomorphisms preserve this structure in a sense that I'll be more specific about as we go on. Okay. So that's the natural, I think that's the natural thing here. And the point I wanted to make is that we've seen that, you know, given this construction, these coordinate transformations are natural, but I didn't make any reference to a metric yet on this space. Okay, whereas in the original discussion, it looked like we were defining a Carroll structure by referencing a metric. Okay, the metric will come at the end, but it's not part of the definition of the Carroll structure. Okay, so generically what I need is one additional geometric structures. And the first one is a so-called Arisman connection. Okay, so the idea is that the fiber bundle that I've described here is about the space itself. What I want to talk about are tangent spaces. Okay, and in order to relate the tangent space of sigma to, say, the tangent space of S in some sense, I need a connection. Okay, so the tangent space of S is simple enough. Right, you can just think of this as having a basis, take the coordinate basis. Okay, and what this Arisman connection does for you is it allows you to lift vectors from the tangent space of the base up into the tangent space of the full space. Okay, so technically the way that people describe this is by first introducing the so-called vertical subbundle. Okay, and this will sound very much like the concept of a kernel that we talked about before. In fact, it's defined to be the kernel of the bundle map. Okay, so this just means that the vertical subbundle is the set of all vectors that project to zero when you project them, down to TS. Okay, and if I was to, since I talked about coordinates on the fibers, a natural choice of basis vector for V, or a natural way to write vectors in V, is to just take partial T times an arbitrary function. Okay, so again, the idea is that, you know, d by dt points in the vertical direction and it projects to zero. Okay, and the connection is the corresponding horizontal subbundle. Okay, so there's a canonical way to, or there's a standard way to split the tangent space into H and V. You can sort of think about H as a stand-in for the tangent space of S, but it's not quite the same thing. And what this does is, as I said, it allows me to lift a vector from TS into the tangent space of the bundle. And I'm gonna, the way I'll write this is I'll think about there being basis vectors for H. Which are, I'm going to write just as partial I. Okay, so you should think of that as we said, that's something in TS. And it lifts to a more general vector that has a partial T component. Okay, and so this looks like a gauge field. Right? It looks like it's form valued. Okay, and this is clearly an H because it's this guy that projects to zero under the projection, but this the guy does not. Okay, so this is in H. Okay, and so good. So to specify this lift, it's equivalent to specifying this spatial form. And in fact, what this guy is it's really the gauge field, the components of the gauge field for the Carroll diffeomorphisms themselves. Okay, so what I mean by that is that if I require that this guy transform covariantly under Carroll diffs, then B transform, then correspondingly, right, I know how the partials transform. I didn't actually write it carefully, but they transform in a precise way. In order for this to be true, B prime, well, there's a rotation of the IJ indices. There's a rescaling by this J. But most importantly, there's a shift by that J, little ji, big ji. And as I said, we interpret that to mean that the Carroll diffeomorphisms are the appropriate transformations, first of all, and the thing that I've introduced here transforms in an appropriate way, in particular nonlinearly. Okay, just to complete the notation that I'm going to use, as I said, I'm going to think of these as basis vectors for H, and in addition, I'm going to introduce a basis vector, which I'll call dt, for V, which I'm going to write as an arbitrary function omega times partial t. Okay, and I'm going to think about this as, well, the analog of this is I'm going to think about dt as equal, as transforming trivially, and what that will mean is that omega transforms by a factor of j. Okay, so I'm just choosing that. I'm introducing omega here, and I'm choosing that in order that the basis vectors transform in a nice way. Okay. Another place that this Arisman connection appears is if I write down the dual one forms. Okay, they have the following form. I'm going to call them E. And, well, the DXIs are just the ordinary DXIs in this basis. Okay, so you can think of BI as a component of this basis vector, or you can also think about it. It appears co-equally in the basis form. Okay, and so what does this mean? All of this means is that if I take a vector, if I take a generic vector in T sigma, okay, by that I mean, you know, something that has time and space dependent coefficients. Like that. Okay. Given all of this setup, under the Carroll diffeomorphisms, Vt is a scalar. And Vi is a vector. Okay, so you know, if you like, the vector is a representation. Is the generic object on the full space, and with respect to this subset of the diffeomorphisms, it decomposes cleanly into a scalar and a vector. Okay. So another couple of remarks. Again, I still haven't introduced a metric as we had before, so let me do that now. Okay, and the idea in this general setup is that it makes sense from the Carroll perspective to introduce a metric on H. Okay, and I'm going to call that G. Okay, why does it make sense? Well, if I define the components of the metric with respect to the basis that I just told you about, okay, they're for now are generally time and space dependent, then under a Carroll diffeomorphism, these things transform tensorially. Okay, so under Carroll. Well, I guess I wrote, it's the same standard formula. Okay, and because I'm describing this as a metric on H, what I mean by that is that if I insert a vector in V, I get zero. Okay, so this is the This is the same sort of formula that we had before, where we're interpreting, or the way that people were thinking about it was that you actually had a metric on the whole tangent space, but it was singular. Okay, here we just have a metric on the horizontal. Okay. Oh, sorry. So let me just say a couple more. Let me introduce some additional notation. So given this set of vectors, a natural thing to do is to compute their Lie brackets. And this will have something to do with the integrability sort of issues that I was referring to earlier, and I'll come back to that in a second. So if you take the Lie bracket of di and dj, it's not too hard to establish that that's something that I'll call fij times a vertical vector. And fij here happens to be of this form. Okay, so it looks like the field strength, right, of the gauge field B. And if I take the Lie bracket of di and dt, what I get is something I'll call var phi times the vertical vector. And phi I here is kind of a similar thing, but it involves time derivatives. Okay. And so so several comments about this. One is that in the fluid correspondence that I referred to earlier and Luca talked about last week, this Fij turns out to be to correspond to the vorticity of the fluid. And the var phi turns out to be an acceleration. Okay, so these are, from the fluid perspective, these are natural objects to expect to appear. Okay, Bi also appears in the fluid story as well. Okay. Very good. And again, as a further remark, this H, so you can think, if you think about H as a distribution, it's a subbundle, right? So you can think about it as a distribution in T sigma. It's an integrable, it's integrable. If the Lie bracket of two horizontal vectors is horizontal. Okay, well here you can see that there is no horizontal piece, it's vertical. Okay, and so in order for H to be integrable, Fij has to vanish. Okay, and I think coming into this, what one might have expected is that integrability condition is somehow important in, say, the existence of BMS symmetry. And what I'm working towards here is to show you that, in fact, that's not true. One doesn't have to assume integrability. And correspondingly, you don't have to be able to think about, you don't have to be, well, integrability means that H you can think of as the tangent space of a space, right, of a submanifold. So it's a little bit general, more general than you might have imagined. Okay, and let me just talk about an example here. Another example. So if I talk about, so let me consider asymptotically flat pair. Okay, and I just want to point out that in fact this is an example. It's a well-known black hole that has some well-known null hypersurfaces, such as infinity or the outer horizon. And in this case, this Bi is non-zero. And in fact, its flux Fij is non-zero as well. Let's see. So one way to One way to write this, I don't think I ever wrote this down.
It's
actually non-zero everywhere.
Oh, so you have some null foliation.
I could talk about a null foliation, or I could just talk about the null hypersurface at infinity and or the horizon.
What's the foliation of curve you're using when you say pi is?
I should write down a metric. And unfortunately, I didn't write it down. So for the horizon, this is the, as I said, I didn't write this down very carefully, but what I did is I went to Boyer-Lindquist coordinates and then introduced a tortoise coordinate. So this is like r squared plus a squared. Delta r is the thing that goes to zero at the horizon. Sorry, let me continue. Okay, so again, it has a similar structure as all the other examples that we discussed. The hypersurface, I've set things up so that the hypersurface is at constant r. Okay, and then the point is that this term is subleading either as I go, if I go to the horizon or the asymptotics, this term is subleading. Okay, but what is the B here? So the metric forgets about B as you go to the hypersurface. Okay, but it's still there as part of the geometric structure. You should remember that it's there, and what is it? Well, it's the dipole field. It goes in standard coordinates. It looks like that, and so F is, if I did that right, F is proportional to the volume form, Fij. Okay, so most examples will have this Arisman. So now I want to interpret this as an Arisman connection on the null hypersurface, as opposed to it somehow being remembered by the metric. Okay, and so most solutions will have such an object. Okay, and finally, because the metric is time dependent, I can introduce time derivatives of the metric, and these just become the familiar concepts of, say, expansion and shear. This is just the time derivative of the determinant. A minus the trace. And that's the shear. Okay, and if you look back through all of this stuff that I wrote, you'll see that the geometric objects that I've introduced consists of the following. So I had a metric and this shear. Okay. I have a one form bi and another one form phi I. And I have scalars, omega and theta. Okay. And if you like, these are sort of with respect to the with respect to the Carroll diffeomorphisms, you can sort of think of these guys as helicity 2. These are helicity 1, and these are helicity 0. Okay, and in particular, these are in one-to-one correspondence with the degrees of freedom that people have found on null hypersurfaces.
What exactly determines what B is in the Kerr case? I see you're going like on the horizon and then you're picking some direction on the horizon to be the horizontal direction, but it is
right. So what I'm really doing is I'm reading off of the metric a coframe. Okay, so I'm saying, right.
But so what's special about it in the case of curve? Is it I don't know.
Well, what do you mean by what's special about it?
Well, just if I'm on a null, the horizon, I could pick some other B to tell you what the horizontal.
That's right, and that would correspond to doing a Carroll diffeomorphism under which B transforms. Okay, but the point is that the Fij that I defined is invariant under Carroll or covariant.
Yes, I guess.
Okay, so this thing is built in. You can choose different Bs, but.
Well,
it's describing the rotation.
It's like if I take any null surface and I actually define the metric by saying I just want to take a slice of the null surface as an actual, codimension to in space-time surface.
Yeah.
That F will always, and then you extend it along, but you'll always get F equals zero for doing that, right?
I suppose locally you will. No, I don't think so.
Because F is telling you whether that horizontal direction is integrable. So if I kind of defined it by just slicing my null hypersurface.
No, it's not. You don't have to go around the surface to detect this.
I know, but I'm just saying any null hypersurface, I could just slice it as with an integrable surface and call that the horizontal direction. And for that choice of B, that F will always vanish, right?
Well, presumably there's some invariant that you can, some global object that you could define, right? Like if this was in two dimension, in four dimensions, and I integrated F over a sphere, it's not zero, right? It's proportional to A. So you can make it go away, I guess, by choosing some singular gauge. So that's what I think was meant by locally. Will, did you?
Yeah, I just wanted to understand whether you could describe sort of geometrically, can I think of half as being resolved from the parallel transport or something? Like I think some vector in my surface can go around some cycle, or is there some?
Yeah, probably, but I haven't thought about that very. Yeah. Okay, I'm running out of time, so let me talk about BMS, and we'll leave it at that. I guess what I want to do is I want to remind you how BMS is obtained, and I want to show you that in fact you can write it in a way that's perfectly covariant with respect to the Carroll diffeomorphisms. Okay? And there's a standard reference, which is Duval, Gibbons, and Horvathy, where they derived the BMS transformations intrinsically on a Carroll manifold, but what they didn't have is any time dependence or Harris-Mann connection. Okay, and so what I want to show you is, in fact, it goes through in this more general setting. So the first thing, so there are sort of two conditions. So what we want to consider are what you might call conformal Carroll transformations, diffeomorphisms. Okay, and the paper that I just mentioned, their point was that this is essentially, if you think about conformal Carroll transformations, this is essentially what leads you to BMS. Okay, intrinsically on a hypersurface. Okay, so there's two conditions here. One is that, in fact, it's a diffeomorphism that preserves the connection or preserves the vertical up to scale. Okay, so I'll generate that by a vector field Xi And the statement is that if you act on a vertical vector, you get the vertical vector back up to some function. Okay, in fact, the solutions of this equation are simply the Carroll diffeomorphism. Since I don't have a lot of time, since I don't have any time, I'm not going to write down the details of this, but let me just say that the solution are Carroll diffs. Okay, and essentially what that is C has to have a time-independent spatial component. Okay, and then the second condition is that it preserve the metric G on H up to scale. Okay, up to some other function, lambda C. Okay, and so you know you can write down the corresponding coordinate expressions here. And I'm really going to cut to the chase. The coordinate expressions here okay, so this is the, you know, this wants to be a conformal Killing equation. And what one finds, if you just for the moment use this, okay, so I have failed to write down the exact equation. So let me be. Somewhat telegraphic. Okay, so there's some terms that involve derivatives of the metric and derivatives C. These are the standard guys. Okay, and you can massage the equation, as it turns out, into the form where everything on the left-hand side just depends on C, which is time independent. And on the right-hand side is Ct, which does depend on time, times the shear. Okay, and what you find here is that, well, okay, so the shear or Ct, or this quantity is acting as a source for this differential equation for C. But the problem is generally there's time dependence everywhere on the left-hand side. Okay, so you're looking for a solution of this differential equation that has to only depend on space, but everything depends on time. Okay, and somewhat miraculously, what happens is that if the shear vanishes, then two things happen. Obviously, the right-hand side becomes zero. And requiring the shear to vanish is equivalent to saying that the time dependence of the metric is pure conformal. In other words, I can do a Weyl transformation that removes the time dependence. Okay, and these equations are in fact Weyl invariant. If I do this Weyl transformation, what happens? As I said, the right-hand side is zero by assumption, and the left-hand side, what it does is it just collapses to the conformal Killing equation on S. Okay, so I can sort of think of this Hij as a metric on TS now, and I then pick up the conformal killing vectors of that. Okay, and it's probably familiar. Okay, so what I've done here is I've just said not only should CI be time independent, but in fact it has to be a conformal killing vector, probably what you expected. But in addition, we have to go back and solve for CT, and when you do that, that's where you find BMS. Okay, and it's the usual thing. The solutions look like vector fields that are generated by vectors that depend on a conformal killing vector Y and a function T, a time independent function T. And it turns out that the solution is just the, as I said, it's just the covariantized expression, or the usual expression for a BMS transformation. Okay, I'm introducing a function curly C, which I'm thinking of as a clock, a local clock. And there's a stuff depends on y. Okay, is that time that stuff times dt? Okay, and this c, as I said, is just the sort of the covariantized time notion, covariantized local notion of time. It's just what I should do is integrate omega inverse. I lost the formula, but this is essentially just integrating the one form that I called E along a vertical to a point T. Okay, and this thing depends on T and X in general. Okay, so it's like you're measuring time independently along each fiber. Okay, so that's what I meant by the expression being covariantized. And these vector fields, the reason that these are BMS is that they, of course, satisfy the BMS algebra. And just to finish up the discussion, one way to describe that is that there's a representation at work here that I'll refer to as M of Y. Okay, it's something that acts on functions. So take a function R. And what it does is it takes the derivative along the killing vector. There's probably a simpler way to write this, but a certain function here that depends on Y multiplying R. Okay, so this is a representation of the CKVs, and it turns out that it's the operation that is actually sitting there. In terms of it, you can write these vectors in a nice way. And if I take the Lie bracket of two of these guys, this is where the BMS is, as usual. We call it T and T prime, Y and Y prime. Okay, the T is about the super translations. So this MY acts on the T's in that way, and then the vector field is the Lie bracket. Okay, so that's the usual BMS algebra. And this M sub Y has some nice properties. In fact, okay, so this you can see doesn't really refer to the connection B in any great way. This looks essentially the same as it did if B is zero. But it does appear if I take the commutator of the M's themselves. So it looks something like, if I remember, it looks like this. Okay, so that works out nicely. But if I'm acting on a function R, Fij comes in here. Times the time derivative of R. Okay, so it looks like the algebra is extended. Okay, and anyway, just let me just finish with that. The I think what's essentially is going on in terms of, you know, understanding the representation theory that you would have to understand in order. To understand the representation theory that would go into CFTs on null hypersurfaces, you have to know something about the representation theory of these guys. Okay, so and this M sub Y is the thing that is really describing the semi-direct product that's involved in this between the CKVs and the supertranslations. Okay, so let me. You finish there.
Any more questions for Ron?
So, just an interpretation question. So,
yeah.
You expect that the CFT should live on S, the base?
I think it lives on the entire null hypersurface.
Right. That's
yeah. No, if you look at Strominger et al. They're looking at soft theorems to try to tell them something about what this holography might be, right? So they're reading S matrix elements in the omega goes to zero limit and trying, you know, basically introducing a stress tensor on S that would reproduce the singularities that they find. Okay, but generically, I think. You know, there will be time dependence, and you need this for that. Anybody else?
In one of these works, I mentioned somebody, they had this similar kind of thing where they find not that these things don't quite close, that there's this sort of extra term, but they were arguing that there is some sense in which this is central or something. You should think of it as like a central extension. Do you see anything like?
Well, I'm still kind of puzzled, to be honest.
Okay.
It looks like some sort of extension, right? But
it's clear
it's about the time dependence somehow. You know, so what does it mean? It's a commutator, so you're sort of going around in a circle, and somehow you're not coming back to where you were. You're being translated in the time direction if you have flux. So.
Are you sure it's a non-trivial central extension?
No, I'm not. That's what I meant when I said.
Because I kind of wonder if it's related to just somehow choosing the connection such that it really is. Well, clearly, if you could set F to zero, somehow it's not there, right?
That's right.
It's related to whether you can slice your null surface by codimension.
Yeah. I mean, I don't. My own feeling is I think you should accept that Fij is really there. You shouldn't try to contort yourself to find a slicing for which it vanishes. I mean, from the fluid perspective, as I said, this is like a vorticity, right? So what do you want to do? You want to go into some frame that's spinning around so that you could do that.
But I'm wondering if the transformation to going to these to where you're not, so to the transformation that you need to do to get rid of the central extension, I would think is related to this transformation to get onto the surfaces that are integrable of the generators.
Well, certainly if it's integrable, Fij is zero and this extension is zero. That's obvious, right? These things are not Carroll transformations because F transforms linearly. So if it's zero, it'll stay zero under Carroll. But that's right. If you think about it as, you want to think about it as somehow getting yourself into a suitable frame, then maybe you can. You would have to use diffeomorphisms that don't preserve, that change the Carroll structure.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because you're saying that connections kind of fix.
The connection is a connection with respect to Carroll diffs, but it transforms horribly under generic diffeomorphisms. The ones that, you know, the ones that don't preserve the vertical. Because it sort of.
Okay, yeah, but you're saying it's part of. It's like it's part of the geometric data, so you
yeah.
don't get to change it. So that's why F is.
I'm still trying to understand this, but I think the reason that, sort of heuristically, the reason that BI transforms non-linearly is that it's really a soft mode. It's one of the Goldstone modes, and it's sort of. Its transformation under Carroll is sort of like moving you along the vacuum manifold. That's the picture. Now I'm trying to firm that up, but that's. Okay, you're good.